Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
Owning a boat comes with a number of perks, like being able to say, ahoy, or land ho, and not feel weird about it. So here's another perk. GEICO's boat insurance offers access to the largest towing fleet on the water. And with specialist support from agents that are as passionate about boating as you are, there's so much value that you'll want to say, shiver me timbers, and not feel weird about that either. Get more with GEICO.
Aeon Byte presents Greatest Disco Hits Part 2.
And I'll briefly cover the similarities between Buddhism and Gnosticism. Right here, right now, Jesus Jones.
Ooh.
First, I'll quote from Stephen Heller's seminal book, Gnosticism, where he reveals several specific features that join Gnosticism and Hinduism. Here they are. One is the teaching regarding the presence of the divine in the human spirit. The Atman is identical with Brahman, which means that the universal divinity is present in miniature within each person. Similarly, in Gnosticism, the Pneuma is a spark sprung from the divine flame. And by knowing the Pneuma, the Gnostic automatically knows the spiritual source from whence it has come. The Hindu and the Gnostic would agree that to know one's deepest self is tantamount to knowing God.
I am an immortal.
You're not a god. You can take my word for it. This is 12 years of Catholic school talking.
Well, maybe the real God uses tricks. You know, maybe he's not omnipotent. He's just been around so long, he knows everything.
Second, both Gnosticism and Hinduism recognize the existence of many divine beings in realms between the ultimate and the material dimensions. Hinduism is the paramount polytheistic religion in the world today, whereas Gnosticism functions within a monotheistic matrix. But Gnosticism can hardly be called a monotheistic religion, pure and simple. Moreover, some of the Vedic deities of Hinduism, such as Indra or Prajapati, have similar qualities to the Gnostic demiurge.
Slugs! Slugs! He created slugs! They can't hear, they can't speak, they can't operate machinery. I mean, are we not in the hands of a lunatic?
Third, Hindu teachings have much to say about what constitutes duality, Vaita, and what is non-dual, Advaita. While Gnosticism is often described as dualistic, its view of both of these categories is actually comparable to the Hindu. Thus, in the realm of what Hinduism calls Maya, illusory manifestation, duality prevails and the struggle of light and dark takes place. While on the plane of ultimate reality, there is a fullness of being comparable to what is known to the Gnostics as the Pleroma.
It's not a place like heaven. It's not something that's not here. It is here in the middle of the turmoil, what's called samsara, the whirlpool of life conditions. That nirvana is what? It is the condition that comes when you are not compelled by desire or by fear or by social commitments.
In the Pali Canon, Buddhism includes the concept of reborn gods. According to this theory, periodically, the physical world system ends and beings of that world system are reborn as gods in lower heavens. This too ends, according to Buddhist cosmology, and God Mahabrahma is then born, who is alone. He longs for the presence of others, and the other gods are reborn as his ministers and companions. Mahabrahma then forgets his past lives and falsely believes himself to be the creator, maker, all-seeing, the Lord.
This is his development build, sealed off so he can control it. He keeps it offline so the custom code he's written can't be detected and deleted.
Yes, it's a bubble universe ruled by an asshole god.
And, as many of you already know, the Buddhist god Mara is a dead ringer for the fierce demiurge of the Sethian Gnostics.
You shall know that God is God, and bow down to his will.
Going back to Heller's book, it provides the similarities between Gnosticism and Buddhism. Heller writes that, quote, "The objective of Buddhism is identical with the ultimate aim of Gnosticism, which is liberation, meaning freedom from embodied existence and thereby from all future suffering. The Bodhisattva ideal and other modifying teachings are only elaborations of this basic teaching.
As long as the Matrix exists, the human race will never be free."
Furthermore, Heller presents the list of points of convergence between Gnosticism and Buddhism, specifically Mahayana Buddhism, based on statements of Buddhist scholar Edward Conzi. Heller writes, "Salvation is achieved through gnosis or jhanan Buddhism, insight into the dependent origination of manifest existence is what liberates. Ignorance is the true root of evil. In Gnosticism, it is called agnosis, and in Buddhism, avidya. Both Gnostic and Buddhist knowledge are arrived, and not by ordinary means, but as the result of interior revelation. There are levels of spiritual attainment, ranging from the condition of a foolish materialist, hyletic, to that of an illumined saint, pneumatic.
We are the future, Charles, not them. They no longer matter."
In both Gnosticism and Buddhism, the feminine principle of wisdom, Sophia and Prashvia, respectively, plays an important role. Kanzi quotes the Hevraja Tantra. Prashvia is called Mother because she gives birth to the world. There are other deities in Buddhism that may be cognate to Sophia, such as Tara and Kuan Yin.
She tore a hole in our universe, gateway to another dimension.
Both Gnosticism and Buddhism show a preference for myth over fact. Christ as well as Buddha are presented as archetypal beings rather than merely historical figures.
Why would he send his own son to suffer for the sins of ordinary people?
Because he loves us. God made himself approachable to us, human, so we could understand him.
That made no sense. Sacrificing the innocent to atone for the sins of the guilty. What kind of love is that?
A tendency to antinomianism, which is disregard for rules and commandments, is inherent in both systems. While at the lower rungs of the spiritual ladder, rules of behavior are considered important and even crucial. In exalted spiritual states, the importance of such rules becomes relative. Both systems are disdainful of easy popularity and aim their teachings to a spiritual elite. Hidden meanings and mysterious teachings are prevalent in both systems. Both Gnosticism and Buddhism are metaphysically monistic, which means they are to aspire to transcend the multiplicity of manifest things and achieve a condition of ultimate oneness.
And beneath that darkness, there's another kind. It was deeper, warm, like a substance. I could feel, man. It was like I was a part of everything that I ever loved. And all I had to do was let go. And I did. And I disappeared.
That's all I got. As I lose my third eye to wisdom, my beloved true seekers. Breaking free from Archon influence, revealing their secret weapon to control us. According to ancient Gnostic lore, the Archons are the ruling agents of the universe and brutal overlords of humanity. Unlike other celestial villains, the Archons aren't interested in eternal damnation or overthrowing some good principle. These omnipotent, thuggish beings are in charge, and that is it. Like traditional demons, they seduce humanity, but the whole mechanism of the cosmos is one big-ass seduction meant to keep the holy part of humans unaware of a higher destiny. Thus, what the Archons want the most in this universe is status quo. How exactly do the Archons seduce and keep us trapped in Maya? Keep the cosmic slaughterhouse factory going? One view is unique, but appropriate in a way any modern person can relate to. To the point of sharing it loudly in a support group. Let's find out before they hear us. Who exactly are the Archons? In a dictionary of Gnosticism, Andrew Philip Smith provides the definition of the Archons. In Gnostic systems, the Archons are the numerous assistants of the Demiurge. They are usually responsible for the creation of the human body. Planetary Archons are also thought to rule over the various spheres through which the soul may ascend. The Archons have a negative role, restraining the spiritual impulses of humanity and directing human affairs for the Demiurge, being responsible for the flood, the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, and the crucifixion of Jesus. Although depicted as hermaphrodite creatures owning bestial faces with an appetite for rape and brawling, the Archons are essentially a mixture of heavenly administrators and hellish union goons. Their greatest tool isn't fear, however, but ignorance, the quote, mother of all evil, according to the Gnostic Gospel of Philip. If humans remain ignorant of their divine origins beyond the universe, the system remains constant, and all is kosher for the Archons. Except the system is, according to the Gnostics, a flawed construct. As Sam Chris wrote in The Atlantic, the physical universe was the creation of the Demiurge, Samael or Yaldabaoth, sometimes figured as a snake with the head of a lion. A blind and stupid god who creates his false world in imperfect imitation of the real creator. The world is a distorted mirror, an image, in other words, a kind of software. In this flawed system, this software, the Archons are demented programmers, coding our fate, precisely every negative aspect of our lives, inner and outer, that slowly break our mental spine. They grant us the counterfeit spirit. It sucks. The method of the Archons. All of this brings us to the specific method the Archons likely use to keep us in abject ignorance, the opposite of liberating gnosis. That is bureaucracy. Really bad bureaucracy. The Archon nature of being the bumbling administrators of the heavens is their greatest weapon. After all, as above, so below, said the Gnostic Hermeticist. While many faiths feel that a celestial bureaucracy is fantastic, from the Pythagoreans to Confucianism, the Gnostics, history's great anarchists, contended it was quite the opposite.
The faulty, quote, software was, ironically, the perfect mechanism to keep us trapped in, as Philip K. Dick called the universe, the Black Iron Prison. It was death by a thousand regulations, death by a thousand frustrations. In the novel Good Omens, written by Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman, a demon, appropriately named Crawley, proves that the Archon Way is superior in the fight against heaven. He demonstrates that traffic jams and phone service outages are far more efficient in damning souls than such common demonic methods as possession or temptation. Death by a thousand frustrations is the best way to dim the human spirit. Ponder this. As humans, we are basically prepared to deal with and overcome life's significant challenges, from a family death to a nearby war, and thus infinity is part of our vibe. It's the little shit in life that seems to get us. Imagine going through a day when the car won't start. You seem to catch every bloody red light. You need five departments at work to sign off on your order for printer cartridges. The customer service representative of your online order is oblivious after you spend an hour trying to connect. Like Morpheus said in The Matrix, it's like a splinter in your mind driving you mad. And these events just don't seem at all like an accident. Between bureaucracy and a faulty system, you can feel your soul dimming, your mind numbing, and your heroic side perishing. You become forgetful and anxious, a Stockholm Syndrome victim to a passive-aggressive kismet. Think of the works of Franz Kafka. Think of Terry Gilliam's Brazil. Think of the next time you have a good idea at work. Think of negotiating with the IRS, experiencing Microsoft updates, or family holiday parties where being comfortably numb is truly the closest you feel to heaven. It's not truly heaven, but that's the game the Archons play. Anyone can get used to fire after a billion years in hell. Anyone can get comfortable with extinction in a Richard Dawkins paradigm. But not even Buddha can handle the local DMV. Like Lao Tzu said, the more laws and order are made prominent, the more thieves and robbers there will be. In an Archon-ruled universe, we are all outlaws who don't even know it, sinking in ignorance by every Mercury retrograde and iPhone upgrade. We are the frogs in the boiling waters of Lethe. How do we fight the Archons? We fight the Archons like the ancient Gnostics did, with knowledge, wisdom, and detachment. To be in the world and not of it, as Jesus explains in the Gospel of John, or as Paul says in Romans 12, do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Thus, in a higher mind and a hermetic sense, don't let them control your mind like most of humanity. As Nicola Denze Lewis writes in her book, Introduction to Gnosticism, the Archons, quote, transcend category, which in the thought world of antiquity was not a good thing. She also writes that they are neither, quote, divine nor clearly demonic. After arming ourselves with the right data to see beyond the software, we must beat the Archons at their game by transcending human categories, becoming neither divine nor clearly demonic. Awaken the essence of Sophia and the alien god that resides within us, sometimes known as the divine spark. The Gnostics utilize many rituals to achieve this, so your mileage may vary. Ultimately, it's about breaking fate, knowing that the Archons truly own our body, that we only rent at a high interest rate, and that our thoughts can become free with the right information. Enjoy this cool and short listicle provided by Dr. Arthur Vosloo from his book, Magic and Mysticism, based on philosopher Hans Jonas's existentialist depiction of Gnosticism. Here it is. 1. A hostile cosmos, Gnostic antipathy to nature. 2. A demiurge, or ignorant creator responsible for botched creation and hostile to human spiritual awakening. 3. Dualism, opposition between the realm of light and the realm of matter. 4. An elaborate mythology. 5. Myths concerning Sophia, wisdom, and her fall and restoration. 6. Belief in a hidden god, not the demiurge. 7. Difficulty of spiritual progress due to the archons or other hostile powers in the cosmos. Ignorance of the inherent fallen human condition. 8. Existence of the Ogdoad, or 8 spheres, including 7 planetary spheres, and possibility of their transcendence. 9. The necessity of gnosis, or direct spiritual knowledge from the realm of light. 10. A revealer or redeemer figure to show the way to the realm of light.
Valentinus believed the world we live in was created by a cruel god, and slightly stupid. A god that will send you plagues, or require sacrifices, or destroy Babylon.
He wasn't wrong about that. The bastard had a mean temper.
Humans can escape this world, and return to the real one. The kingdom. And for that, you needed to achieve the Gnosis, which could be described as true knowledge.
Aeon Byte Short.
Eric Davis. High weirdness, drugs, esoterica, and visionary experience in the 70s. Dick's vision of Valis, in particular, reads like an uncanny prophecy of our fraught network consciousness. On the one hand, we have become thoroughly absorbed into an all-consuming, endlessly arborizing, weirdly discarnating information system. But with the onset of the Internet of Things and the spread of smartphones, sensors, GPS devices, and augmented reality, the network no longer inhabits a separate, quote, cyberspace. Instead, it is now invading, reconfiguring, and rewriting physical reality. Very much the way Dick describes Valis, using the world of objects to organize and extend itself into our spurious reality. We find ourselves in a state of profound ambivalence, interpolated into nodes of post-human network, even as we go about our ordinary lives.
Yes, it's a bubble universe ruled by an asshole god.
As Dick writes in The Exegesis, our little psyche world systems are perpetually bombarded with incoming information, which we process and, at the right time to the right other stations, we transmit in the rightly modified form. All this takes place through us as if we were transistors, diodes, wire condensers, and resistors. All none the wiser. Meanwhile, our close private world engages our attention with challenges, pain and delight, so that we will not merely subsist as slave components with nothing to do but function. Without a world, we would degenerate fatally during the standby periods. Meanwhile, we have food, music, books, and friends. Sound familiar? More and more of us sacrifice more and more of our lives on the altar of information processing.
as we submit to an increasingly invasive and persuasive network that demands that we respond, link, like, retweet, and magnify our personal social networks. But Dick is also imagining something more subliminal here. More like the way we unknowingly feed the hungry algorithms of the big data cloud farms with the invisible breadcrumbs of our digital activity. Here Dick approaches the grim declaration of the French philosopher and PKD exegete, Jean Baudrillard, who wrote, around the time of Dick's death, that the contemporary subject has now become, quote, only pure screen, a witching center for all the networks of influence.
So much of consciousness is a burden, a weight, and we have spared them that. Anxiety, self-loathing, guilt. The hosts are the ones who are free. Free, here, under my control.
But please, let me read you another passage from The Marvelous High Weirdness, which is truly a manual to break through this virtual reality hellhole. Here Eric talks about how Gnosis works in these days in this infernal battleground we call Earth. Such edgy awakenings, whether we see them as, quote, spiritual or not, are an important component to the work of emancipation, which is perhaps the supreme value shared across the fissure of the counterculture. Motivating radical leftists, hippie seekers, and psychedelic anarchists alike. Paradoxically, however, the goals of emancipation and liberation were often paired at the time with sociological ideas and structural analysis that radically decentered the autonomous individual psyche. Attitudes, motives, dreams and drivers, even the persona experience of reality itself, were, it was argued, shaped or programmed by often pernicious political, institutional, and ideological forces. So who is there to be liberated?
I will not make any deals with you. I've resigned. I will not be pushed, filed, stamped, indexed, briefed, debriefed, or numbered. My life is my own.
This koan suggests the way to the sociological, cultural, and ideological analysis already lend themselves to a kind of conspiracy thinking. But to truly escape these influences and imprints, if only to turn around and reconstruct society, something more than critique is required. The external struggle, whether collective or anti-authoritarian, needed to be paralleled with the internal work of, quote, raising consciousness, of becoming, in contemporary terms, quote, woke. Gnosis, raising consciousness to peak of world-rending insight, becomes in this context a political gesture, one that both illuminates the dark archons that manipulate reality and provides a direct experience of that part of the self that seeks, or is, liberation itself. Awakening here is not an escape from the wheel, but a vertiginous discernment that goes against the grain.
I say, the empire never ended. The empire is the institution, the codification of derangement. It is insane and imposes its insanity on us by violence, since its nature is a violent one. To fight the empire is to be infected by its derangement. This is a paradox. Whoever defeats a segment of the empire becomes the empire. It proliferates like a virus, imposing its form on its enemies. Thereby, it becomes its enemy. Against the empire is posed the living information, the plasmate or physician, which we know as the Holy Spirit or Christ Discorporate. Since the universe is actually composed of information, then it can be said that information will save us. This is the saving gnosis which the Gnostics sought. There is no other road to salvation.
Hope you enjoyed. Please support for more heresies. Aeon Byte, Gnostic Radio.
At 40, Kafka, who never married and had no children, walked through the park in Berlin when he met a crying girl who had just lost her favorite doll. They both searched for the doll unsuccessfully. Kafka told her to meet him there the next day and they would come back to look for her. The next day, after not finding the doll, Kafka gave the girl a letter written by the doll saying, "Please don't cry. I took a trip to see the world. I will write to you about my adventures." Thus began a story that continued until the end of Kafka's life. During their meetings at the park, Kafka read the letters of the doll, carefully written with adventures and conversations that the girl found adorable. Finally, Kafka brought back the doll. He bought one that had returned to Berlin. "It doesn't look like my doll at all," said the girl. Kafka handed her another letter in which the doll wrote, "My travels have changed me." The little girl hugged the new doll and brought her happily home. A year later, Kafka died. Decades later, the now adult girl found a letter inside the doll. In the tiny letter signed by Kafka, it was written, "Everything you love will probably be lost, but in the end, love will return in another way." Of course, since Kafka was a modern Gnostic, as many scholars have contended, I would say there is another lesson to this story beyond the return of love. And that is that Kafka was simultaneously himself, the doll, and the little girl. He was in his own gospel and own myth, as nobody really has ever verified this story. But we do know that when we fall into a nice fiction, our own stories, we are everyone we meet, and our psyches will often fragment to survive the archons of hell world and to create better than the creator gods and their Karens and Kadamites in the establishment. 8 Ancient Gnostic Women Leaders. Number 1. Salome, disciple of Jesus in several Gnostic texts, including the Gospel of the Egyptians, founder of the Carpocratian Gnostic sect. Number 2. Marcellina, founded Gnostic church in Rome in the 2nd century, taught social egalitarianism and led multitudes away from orthodoxy. Number 3. Helen, one of the 30 disciples of John the Baptist, consort of Simon Magus, high priestess of the moon, and later leader of her own sect. Number 4. Miriam, first century seer and priestess from the Euphrates marshes, who founded a group of Gnostic Baptists that evolved into the Mandeans. Number 5. Mary Magdalene, main disciple and companion of Jesus, seer in her own right, honored by several Gnostic communities and in apocryphal texts. Number 6. Miriam, disciple of James the Just and founder of the Nassines or serpent-worshipping Gnostics. Number 7. Mary the Jewess, quoted by Gnostic mystic Zosimos of Panopolis, she was an inventor and is considered the first true alchemist of the Western world. Number 8. Jezebel, Nicolaitan leader mentioned in the Book of Revelation, prophetess and seductress, whose teachings included the deep things of Satan. Data taken from church father accounts, Christian folklore, and apocryphal texts, including the Nag Hammadi Library, as well as the Gnostic New Age by Dr. April DeConnick, a Dictionary of Gnosticism by Andrew Phillips Smith, and The Other Goddess by Dr. Joanna Cuyala. The very women of these heretics, how wanton they are, for they are bold enough to teach, to dispute, to enact exorcisms, to undertake cures, it may even to baptize. Tertullian, Prescription Against Heretics, 41. Where there is smoke, there is the fire of ancient priestesses that cannot be contained by the simulation. Sophia Rising. For more gnosis to expose the simulation, visit the Virtual Alexandria, the God above God.com.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
Imagine that you're standing in the middle of the floor of a prison cell. Around you are solid concrete walls and a solid steel door. The only window is a small slit on the back wall of your cell, but it's so high up above your head that you can't see out of it unless you grip the ledge and haul yourself up with sheer brute strength. Imagine that you pull yourself up there by your fingertips, actually feeling what it would be like. The muscles in your hand, forearms, and biceps all activated and getting more exhausted by the second. The rough texture of the wall scraping your belly and thighs as you struggle to ascend. The cold steel of the window bars around your hands. When you finally pull yourself up above the ledge, you're nearly blinded by a brilliant light from the outside. It's the light of creation, and it bursts into the window and makes everything disappear. There's only the light, no prison cell, no window, and no you. Nothing exists anymore but infinite light. That's the meditation. Just like the pull-up or chin-up you're imagining yourself doing, one repetition is probably not enough to do much. There aren't any rules as to how many times you should visualize the above, but I think 10 reps is a good start. And when that becomes easy, try working your way up to 100 times. When you get truly proficient at it, you'll notice a peculiar sensation. As you imagine the light obliterating everything, including you, you'll start to feel as you've been cast back into your body, gently, yet forcefully. You'll also experience a temporary state of being grounded in the present moment, in your physical form, with no stray thoughts whatsoever.
I do not know whether the gods are faces that we give to that which is faceless in order to comprehend it and be close to it as human beings. If they are manifestations of distinct powers arising from an unknowable immensity or supreme reality or a oneness. If they are mediators or messengers between us and the God who is beyond comprehension. If they are aspects of nature and the world personified. If they are archetypes or forces of consciousness both within and without man. Or if they are at the highest human expression of being beyond mortality. Perhaps they are a combination of all of the above. What I do know is that the gods are mysteries, and that we as human beings are ultimately drawn to them. And I know that they respond if one calls out to them. In times when the shrouds between worlds are temporarily unveiled, when our universe expands, they make themselves manifest. For this to happen, one has to live poetically and live strongly. One has to live a life of great deeds, of overcoming, a life worthy of divine attention. One has to boldly face great sorrow and greater joy, for the gods have no interest in dull normalcy. Infinite divinities await, hidden within man himself, which is always the place of the final pilgrimage. The godlight becomes living reality when dreams intersect with the waking world. These are knife-edge moments when the mythic cuts through the temporal to reveal the timeless, where the spirit is elevated to its superior states, where the poetic takes flight over the rational. In moments such as these, the gods awaken and reclaim their seat in the soul. We can hear them when we call out for them, in the crash of thunder and in the whisper of rustling leaves, in the creak of frosted towering evergreens and in the roar of waves, in the solemn song of eternal dawn and in the ecstatic cries of battle and love. And we wait for the furor of their return. Burn, baby, burn. The gods are coming.
Free your mind.
What is he doing?
He's beginning to believe.
Emanuela. In my wanderings on the face of the earth, I came across a lovely and enchanting lady, which went by the name of Emanuela, she of the blue eyelids and daughter of the azure sunset. Emanuela was my dream among the nightmares of the world, and in her arms I felt like a god which loves in his temple of desire, and has no cares or concerns for the everyday world of petty and spiteful mankind. Emanuela was my goddess, and I worshipped her with nameless rites, which were old when the world was young. And in my love of her, I experienced total and glorious abandon. In my days with my beloved Emanuela, I kept a lookout for the scavengers and predators who stalked the lonely and deserted corridors of the night, landing on the shore of a hot tropical island, and ready to violate my sweet and precious Emanuela, young and nubile, and lust-driven before the winds of Pazuzu, god of the hot desert winds and of pestilence. In my time with my lady Emanuela, I became as a babe in a mother's arms, oblivious to thought and sensation. With Emanuela, I was in the seas of eternity, and I did not care where my ship landed. In her forbidden regions, I was not myself, and I did not know who I was or where I was at. Time had no meaning for me, because when I was with Emanuela, time was not, and I was not. In the days of our lovemaking, we looked over the shores of infinity and took our fill of love and lust, not caring whether all of creation lived or died. Many a time I died in her arms, only to be resurrected with a whisper and a kiss. Emanuela was my life and my love.
When the world became her master, I became her slave. Many have entered her, and many have forgotten her. But I, Vasil Bakagias, have her transcriptions of love etched in my tormented soul, and I am forevermore a lord of her sweet and sensual passions, and a keeper of her secret and arcane mysteries. For it is written in the lost annals of love's forbidden and unknowable tome that Emanuela, daughter of the azure sunset and she of the blue eyelids, was my only true love in this world of lesser beings and senseless destinies. Hail the starry void of love.
Emil Cioran, Gnostic Quotes. Narrated by David Topala.
It's not worth the bother of killing yourself, since you're doing it too late anyway. When the last illiterate will disappear, mankind will disappear. The bitterness of existence dissipates at the idea that it's in our own power to stop it, that we hide within ourselves the freedom of our own absence. When you're trying to convert someone, you don't do it to save him, but to make him suffer the same way as you do. To suffer means being active without doing anything. Accurately, you cannot ask yourself what life is, but what is not. Anyone can achieve salvation in his sleep. Everyone's a genius when he sleeps. There's no difference between the dreams of a shepherd and the dreams of a poet. A book needs to deepen your wounds, or even create them in the first place. A book must be a danger. Building a family? I'd rather build an empire. Aging is just the punishment for existing. Any utopia close to its fulfillment looks like a cynical dream. The difference between man and the animal is that the animal can only be an animal. But humans can be inhuman. They can be something other than themselves. The fact that I exist proves that the world doesn't make any sense. If I ever go mad, I would like to have that kind of madness just to laugh without control. We are not running forward towards our death, but running away from the catastrophe of our own birth. Being alive. I'm suddenly struck by the weirdness of such a claim, as if it applies to nobody. The feeling of being late or early by 10,000 years compared to the others, longing only to the beginnings or the ends of mankind. When you're absolutely convinced that everything is an illusion, you don't have to bother proving it. Sometimes you wish you were a cannibal, not because you want to eat certain individuals, but because you want to vomit them. Everything alive in our folklore came before Christianity, and that's true with any one of us as well. By being born, we lost the same amount that we will lose by being dead. My views on the future are so clear that if I had children, I would kill them in an instant. God exists, even though he doesn't. Nothing deserves to be destroyed because nothing deserves to be created. If I never trusted Freud, it's solely my father's fault. He was always telling my mother his night dreams, thus ruining my mornings. Religions, like all ideologies that inherited their vices, are only crusades against laughter. Whatever dies has never existed. We should only speak about our sensations and our visions, never about ideas, because they are never truly ours. Existence would be justifiable if only everyone acted as if they were the last human alive. Whatever I know destroys whatever I wish. It's utterly impossible to love God in a different way other than by hating Him. If life was real, who could endure it? As a dream, it is a mixture of delight and terror which we abandon ourselves to. The spirit is nature's nightmare. I'm thinking about men and see only shadows. I'm thinking about shadows and see only me. Objection against science. The world is not worth knowing. Whenever we're afraid, we are the victims of our own future. Insomnia is the only heroic act compatible with the bed. Does the sun shine to keep us warm? Does the night exist in order for us to dream? Does the sea exist so we can navigate through it? Since the world has had meaning, it lost its primal existence. Writing is a postponed aggression. I only write to avoid acting my vengeance. For hundreds of years, humanity has looked at the heavens through a cannon hole. Whoever hasn't died young deserves to die. This is actually the conclusion of his book, The Evil Demiurge. We are all living on the bottom of a hell where each second is a miracle. A civilization is destroyed only when its gods are destroyed. Thus, Christianity, unable to attack the empire itself, attacked its religion. Why should we rebel against the symmetry of this world, since chaos itself is just a system of disorders? After spending enough time contemplating the idea of your own nothingness, you can't help but see yourself as God. Bach, Shakespeare, Beethoven, Dostoevsky, and Nietzsche are the only argument against monotheism. I cannot understand how one could possibly believe in God, although I am daily thinking about Him. Any thought bores me to death if it doesn't contain at least a slight sign of brutality. You cannot live without the gods, nor with them. I wish I wrote a rehabilitation of all heresies. Only nothingness and illusion are real. I wish I was the contemporary of nobody. We truly love a friend only when he dies. The fools build the world, and the wise destroy it.
The origins of totalitarianism and thought control. Most are aware of the terms Orwellian, political correctness, Thought Police, or Brave New World, as well as the oppressive secular and religious systems throughout history that inspired them. Although assumed that these individuality-killing mechanisms are relatively modern constructs, the reality is that they are not only as old as Christianity but originated with Christianity itself. In his book, The New Inquisition, Arthur Fairchlausch proposes that it was the heresy hunting of the early church fathers that spawned the very DNA for later totalitarian and police state institutions. Before the rise of the heresiologists, empires conquered almost solely for natural resources, slavery and prestige. For the most part, subjugated nations could keep their native faiths, customs and ideologies. Religious persecution within an empire usually arose when a certain priesthood or nobilitied earthly representatives of their specific gods ignited some form of insurrection. Per Fairchlausch, a seismic shift away from this attitude occurred in the 2nd century CE when Christianity began to solidify itself as an organized religion instead of multiple, independent sects. Church fathers such as Irenaeus of Lyons and Tertullian of Carthage saw the need to streamline the dogmas of their maturing religion to gain respectability within the Roman Empire. Dissent or autonomous speculation could threaten the very survival of Christianity, at least that was their rationale. They drew a harsh line in the doctrinal sand, referring to their form of Christianity as orthodoxy, from the Greek for right thinking. On the other side stood the Gnostics, who they labeled heretics, from the Greek to choose, in the context of independent thought diverging from standard norms. The demarcation spread to entire communities, as more heretics were exposed, and the term conveniently broadened to other sects, religions and even political principles. In other words, an enemy was no longer defined by action, outward allegiance or even citizenship, but by their very thoughts. As the Orthodox wing grew and copulated with the Roman government, volumes of texts were written on how to recognize, decipher and correct those who had made a choice away from right thinking. Thinking for the first time in history could be criminalized by the state. This template for totalitarian control wasn't fully perfected until the arrival of the Inquisition in the 12th century. Despite common perception, the Inquisition was not implemented to deal with Jews, witches or other minorities, but ironically against the Gnostics, the rebellious Cathars of southern France. With the blessing of the Pope, and the greed of opportunistic nobles, heresy hunting became fully weaponized to counter the resilience of the medieval Gnostics. Despite the advent of the Age of Enlightenment and democratic nations, history clearly reveals that the repressive formula of the early church fathers and medieval inquisitors was never abandoned. The new Inquisition offers the infamous examples of authoritarian regimes and their thought police, the French Revolution corruptors, European/Asia Marxism, Nazism, and various spectrums of fascism. Yet Fairchlausch proffers evidence of intellectuals who influenced notorious despotic movements, directly or indirectly, who were very well aware of the heresy hunters and their methodologies. Many certainly summoned the bogeyman of the Gnostics when needed. The question might arise of why the book is called The New Inquisition, since thought crime is an unkillable contagion that mutates and migrates to different hosts. The answer is the warning of Fairchlausch that the heresy hunting virus is still considered a viable toxin by many in power, even in free societies. The satanic panic and Illuminati phobia of the 1980s and 1990s in the West are two cases that fortunately did not evolve into literal witch hunts. This organization is a Christian Illuminati creating false Illuminati implanted in the minds of the population to create schisms and manufacture threats, making it easier to control public perception. The grim truth is that the heresy hunting slash inquisition golem will never be destroyed, built in the infernal imagination of those who feel that the greater good means little free will and free thinking. And, as Feschlausch points out, it is a dark irony that the main scaremongers of these two examples, Pat Robertson and Tim Leahy, were members of the clandestine Council for National Policy. The Gnostics took the first blows from this golem, and beyond countless millions have paid dearly because of nothing more than an idea to punish ideas. The modern-day Inquisitor no longer requires torture chambers or bribed neighbors. The internet, electronic messaging, and social media have made the public's thoughts more accessible than ever. All it takes to contaminate liberty is one wedding day between a dictatorial belief system and the state. Overnight, an individual's thoughts can be transformed into damning witnesses in a kangaroo court. Ideas can indeed change the world. But some ideas are best left in the infernal imagination of certain people, lest we get a brave new world and its golems.
The Gnostic Robert Frost. The Gnostic spirit has survived and even thrived throughout history, despite the often tectonic pressure of orthodoxy and its habit of micromanaging history and reality itself. These manifestations of the Song of Wisdom are sometimes found where least expected. Robert Frost would certainly be under this category. Most experts agree that Frost was not a religious man, often referring to himself as a free thinker. However, one of his lesser-known poems not only betrays but explicitly underscores the Gnostic sensibility and mythos itself. It is called The Demiurge's Laugh. In ancient times, the demiurge was considered the active and creative aspect of the supreme consciousness. Even Christianity adopted this form of dualism. But only one group saw the demiurge in a negative light, the Judeo-Christian Gnostics. If Frost had a spiritual view, there are indications it came close to the Gnostics or that he came to similar conclusions. In Robert Frost, A Life, J. Panini states that Frost saw God as the fierce Jehovah of the Book of Job and not the more gentle Elohim who visited Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. In Robert Frost, Harold Bloom spends considerable time revealing the Gnostic instincts of Frost, going so far as to call him a shrewd Gnostic who understood that behind the ostensibly inviting canopy of nature lay a transcendental force ready to crush the human spirit. Bloom writes that Frost believed in the Gnostic identity of the knower of what is known, when the sparks of the alien god or true workman stream through you. Bloom offers Frost's poem, Uriel, to support his claims. Furthermore, Bloom reveals that Frost never truly saw the universe as benign or filled with providence. He quotes the last letter ever written by Frost, which echoes the Gnostic enigma on existence. How can we be just in a world that needs mercy and merciful in a world that needs justice? Bloom declares that the demiurge, the demon of the dark woods of creation, laughs at us because of this conundrum. As Stefan Huller once said, any serious artist is already half a Gnostic. Most artists who delve deep into the imaginative realm will sooner or later tap into Gnostic axioms. The artist will create but will also find himself destroying the very fabric of the dark woods of creation. Bloom himself claimed this is the Gnostic dictum, everything that can be broken should be broken. The Gnostic spirit provides this stark message, the demiurge crafted reality and thought of himself as the greatest of artists. But he was really nothing more than a counterfeiting, mechanical artisan, and now laughs at humanity in order to repress its superior, creative talent. Forgive, O Lord, my little jokes on thee, and I'll forgive thy great big one on me. Robert Frost.
The Gnostic Moby Dick. Most of us have read Moby Dick, or are at least familiar with Herman Melville's classic. But Moby Dick, a Gnostic tale? Don't take my word for it, but take the insights of one of my favorite books when it comes to an exposition on the Gnostics, The Elements of Gnosticism by Stuart Holroyd. 1. Raging Against Heaven. As Holroyd writes, Melville, like Goethe and William Blake before him, drew upon the Gnostic tradition and contributed to it. In a typical Gnostic manner, Melville employed allegory, ambiguity, and irony to both reveal and conceal his meaning. The novel is a strange amalgamation of realism and symbolism, of adventure yarn and metaphysical allegory. Captain Ahab, who is described as madness maddened and talks more like an Old Testament prophet than of a seafarer, reveals the Gnostic ethos of the novel toward the end when addressing the Creator God. Thou knowest not how came ye, hence, callest thyself unbegotten, certainly knowest not thy beginning, hence callest thyself unbegun. I know that of me, which thou knowest not of thyself, O, thou omnipotent. There is some use of using thing beyond thee, to whom all thy eternity is but time, all thy creativeness mechanical. The Creator God of Moby Dick is the same deficient, tyrannical, and ignorant being the Gnostics warned about, and his earthly manifestation is the white whale. According to Holroyd, Melville hid Gnostic philosophy in his work because it was dangerous and because he embraced it. In The Gnostics, Sean Martin summarizes well the Gnostic theme of Moby Dick. Ahab's quest to destroy the white whale can be seen as nothing less than a comprehensive revolt against the Demiurge and all his works. 2. White Whale Privilege. There is more Gnosticism in the novel beyond the jihad against petty deities. The one weakness in calling Moby Dick a full-blown Gnostic narrative is a lack of a Gnostic revealer in the vein of Jesus, Sophia, Hermes, or Morpheus. Ahab is not exactly driven by gnosis, but fury and revenge. I don't know if wrath can be an element of gnosis, but the novel is certainly a cautionary tale of mind-breaking, soul-racking journey of individuals once they have awakened. Beyond Holroyd's argument, we have the divining article Gnostic Mythos in Moby Dick by Thomas Vargish. Although the author does contend Melville drew from a deep well of heterodoxy, Zoroastrianism, Hinduism, and Platonism. 3. But was Melville a Gnostic? As Stefan Huller explains in his book Gnosticism, Melville was part of the stream of writers who were beneficiaries of the conscious effort of some of the great luminaries of the Enlightenment. To rehabilitate the Gnostics and to take away the ugly image foisted upon them through the ages by endless repetitions of the Church Fathers' slander. In other words, Melville was one of the great artists who uncovered the truth behind the fake news of the victors who wrote history. Those who attempted to camouflage the awe and horror of the cosmos and create false gardens of Eden for humanity. Then again, Melville did write a poem and Cathar homage called Fragments of a Lost Gnostic Poem of the 12th Century.
We hope you enjoyed Greatest Disco Hits Part 2.
Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest, over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that?
Yeah.
No hassle?
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.